This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Vaccines are starting to reach poor countries, but it's going to be a long slog.
We expect vulnerable populations in every country will be able to be covered by 2022.
Meanwhile, up in Canada, the vaccine rollout is off to a bumpy start.
Sluggish is probably a generous term. It's been, quite frankly, a disaster, and it's been tragic.
And in Iraq, they've got a high-profile visitor. Pope Francis is there, and many Iraqis are loving the attention.
Watching international coverage of the event, I think it has helped to shed light on a different aspect of Iraq.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, a Nobel Prize-winning author creates a new character, a robot capable of love.
I think she's more like a doll in children's literature.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Today in Beijing, China's leadership opened the National People's Congress. Delegates clapped in time as Chinese leader Xi Jinping and other top leaders walked in. It's a week-long government meeting that will help create a roadmap for China's future. The World's Rebecca Canther has been paying attention from Shanghai. So, Rebecca, the National People's Congress sounds very official and pro forma. It's held annually, pre-rehearsed, clearly, with that clapping perfectly in time. But is there anything different this year?
So, yep, every spring, China holds these two meetings to plan out the political direction of the country. And this year is especially important because the government announced its 14th five-year plan as well. And that covers a longer-range vision for China. And it's like about everything from technology and business to healthcare, the environment. It covers a lot of bases.
So I'm imagining lots of speeches.
Yes, but everyone was paying very close attention to one speech in particular today. So that was Premier Li Keqiang, and he spoke to delegates this morning, and he was giving a report about the year that's gone by and the targets for this year. He announced a target of more than 6% GDP growth for this year and the creation of 11 million new jobs. And he touched on so many different topics that cover all sectors of society. It's just too much to take in. There were these broad statements and targets to reach, and then very specific changes that will affect everyday people's lives and businesses. So he mentioned everything from curbing carbon emissions, modifying the tax rates, raising the retirement age. He talked about defense spending, the birth rate. I mean, there was just so much to take in.
The birth rate, what's going on there? I mean, that's always a sort of sensitive issue in China. What's behind that?
Well, you know, China is an aging society, so the government would like to increase the birth rate. There was a one-child policy. I think they were hoping that with the ending of that policy, people would choose to have more kids, and that just hasn't been the case so far.
Now, Rebecca, I know you were watching this National People's Congress on TV. How much attention do people really pay to it around China?
It's on top of all the news. It's all over social media. And so I went out and I talked to people on the street today, and I talked with many of them. They told me that they use these meetings as a way to get a kind of signal about how their lives might change in the year ahead. I spoke with this driver, Chen Qiang, and he says he was scanning his phone for updates throughout the day because he wanted to see what direction the country was going in. And he said even though his income had dropped substantially because of the pandemic, he was getting signals that made him feel really secure about his and the country's future.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and then I talked to another guy. This is Mi Junling. So he's a food delivery man, and he said he was really skeptical about the 6% growth target for this year. He said he has two kids and his parents to take care of. In a good month, he makes $1,200, but he's always getting stopped by the traffic police. He doesn't feel like his life is improving or that the government is helping him at all.
So it's interesting. You're talking to Chinese who feel like they're directly affected by this National People's Congress. What about people outside China? Do they pay attention to it?
China watchers around the world are paying attention because it offers a look at where China sees itself going. So, you know, last year at the two sessions, China announced the new national security laws that brought about so many changes in Hong Kong. And in today's speech, Li Keqiang said that China would guard against interference from external forces in Hong Kong. That's another hint at maybe even tighter control over Hong Kong in the coming year.
So I know the National People's Congress goes on for a while, but I gather from what you've been saying that a lot of the pronouncements were made today.
Yes, the first day is typically when a lot of big decisions get announced, but it's a week-long set of meetings, and then Xi Jinping will speak at the closing session next week. And since this year is also the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party, I expect his closing speech is going to focus on that as well as sort of reinforce this government vision going forward.
The World's Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai telling us about the China National People's Congress that began today. Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
Thank you.
As Rebecca just said, China's five-year blueprint has impacts far beyond its own borders, like how it tackles climate change. China emits more greenhouse gas pollution overall than any other country. Many environmentalists were hoping that Beijing's latest long-term plan would map out a major change. Instead, it offers only incremental ones. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
Chinese President Xi Jinping surprised the world in September when he announced something that was a major change. He told the UN that his country would reach carbon neutrality, emitting no new carbon that it didn't offset by 2060.
We have to form quickly a green way of development and of life and build the ecological civilization and a beautiful earth.
His announcement marked a major departure from previous policy, but there were no specifics on how the country would get there. So all eyes looked ahead to the release of this five-year plan. Swithin Lei works on the Climate Action Tracker at the new Climate Institute think tank.
Whatever is said on the international community or for media, it only means something if it's also reflected in the five-year plan.
Activists set their hopes pretty high for this plan. Instead of hitting peak carbon emissions by 2030, as President Xi announced in September, they'd hoped the country might move that date forward.
What everyone really wanted was an earlier peaking year. There's lots of analysis that suggests China can peak carbon emissions earlier if they want.
And they looked for a signal that China would put a cap on coal, which the country is heavily dependent on for power and jobs.
This is the kind of runaway train in China.
But the plan has no such sweeping changes, and Lei calls it underwhelming. Speaking to the party conference today, Premier Li Keqiang said China will continue to promote coal while making a major push to develop new energy sources. The plan doesn't set a hard cap on emissions either. Instead, it ties carbon reduction targets to economic output. That's similar to the last five-year plan. And its renewable energy target is also in line with one previously set.
There's nothing really new or exciting in these headline targets. And so I think that's probably the most disappointing piece.
This is Angel Hsu, an assistant professor of environment and energy at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. But she says this makes sense. Five-year plans require years of negotiations. She wouldn't expect a blueprint for how to meet an ambitious new target set just in September to be included in this one.
So I still think that there's a window for China to come up with those specific details that could then enhance the climate and energy targets that we're seeing. To me, I'm still optimistic.
There is one big change in this plan, though, that some believe signals a shift in how China thinks about economic growth and sustainable development. The plan is the first in recent years to not have a five-year target for growth in China's gross domestic product, or GDP. Some say China doesn't want to set a goal it can't meet amid pandemic-era uncertainty. But Alvin Lin thinks there's more to it. He's the China Climate and Energy Policy Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council in the Beijing office.
Dropping that GDP growth target is kind of a signal from central policymakers to the provincial and city officials that they shouldn't just focus on GDP growth anymore.
Environmental factors should also be considered.
It's a change in mindset about what development means within China. I think that's the positive way to read this.
There may be more signals from China soon enough. Another big announcement about carbon emissions is likely to come later this year ahead of a key UN climate meeting in Glasgow. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Vaccines are starting to get out to the world's less wealthy nations. Places like Ghana, Nigeria, and Rwanda are receiving doses. The shots are arriving thanks to COVAX, an international initiative designed to distribute vaccines equitably around the world. But is it enough? The World's Alana Gordon has been following the rollout. Alana, what does it mean that COVAX has finally begun?
A lot of people are celebrating. Hundreds of thousands of doses are finally being delivered to dozens of countries. Here's Dr. John Nkengasong. He's head of Africa's Centers for Disease Control, speaking with leaders of COVAX this week.
Let me join others in characterizing this day as a historic moment for our collective fight against this pandemic, which is a true symbol of the significant milestones that have been achieved.
And Carol, the stakes are that globally, more than a quarter billion vaccines have been given out so far, just as like the latest update. But, you know, until now, a lot of low and middle income countries just have been left on the sidelines.
But how much can COVAX really do to make up for the huge inequities in access around the globe?
Well, if the goal is to get the majority of populations vaccinated and to prevent the spread of coronavirus, this is just not nearly enough. I talked with Andrea Taylor. She's an assistant director of Duke University's Global Health Innovation Center. She's based in the UK. Her team has been tracking these efforts, including COVAX.
With COVAX and with all the other purchases that have been made and that we expect to see, we think that each country will get to at least 10% coverage by the end of 2021. And then we expect that vulnerable populations in every country will be able to be covered by 2022. But we don't think that most countries will be able to reach herd immunity, which is 60 to 70% coverage before 2023.
2023? I mean, yeah. That's amazing. I mean, given how President Biden here in the U.S. is projecting that all Americans will be able to get a vaccine by May, what's the issue?
Right now, Taylor and others agree that the pressing issue is the supply itself. Like, there just aren't enough vaccines being made for the world. And then adding to that, obviously, are these competing incentives, bilateral deals, countries racing to buy supplies directly and putting their own populations first. Carol, Canada is a really interesting example of this. It bought a lot of vaccines, like for way more than its population. But it doesn't manufacture these vaccines locally. They just don't have them. They're not at the front of the list. And so Canada right now is even on the COVAX list to get doses of vaccines through the program. And that's gotten some criticism.
So what can be done to expand the supply of vaccines to make COVAX a faster process for countries to get the vaccine?
Well, a key part of expanding the supply more broadly is just having more manufacturing capacity and more manufacturers that can make the vaccines. This can get really complicated. Companies that develop the drugs control who can make it. And the process to make these vaccines is also complicated. So it's not just like anyone can do it.
And of course, we have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that's being touted for all sorts of reasons. And also the news that they're going to let Merck make its vaccine, manufacture it. What's the significance of that?
That's a really good example of what's happening in the U.S. There's actually a global movement to require companies to share this knowledge, Carol, but it's facing pushback. And then there's efforts focused on improving local manufacturing capacity so that there are these hubs around the world that can make vaccines. So Dr. John Nkengasong with the Africa CDC, who we heard from earlier, he and other leaders in Africa are really keen on increasing this regional manufacturing capacity. Because again, even when they can afford to pay for these vaccines made elsewhere, they're often left waiting. The final thing, Carol, that we haven't taken into account with all this and these projections are variants. Let's say the world needs booster shots for these vaccines because of the variants or something that adjusts to the variants that are circulating. If you need something like this, that's going to increase the manufacturing needs. It's going to put a real wrench in the timelines for vaccinating the world because you're going to need extra shots going out everywhere, and that's also going to compound the manufacturers that are making the vaccines right now. So it just means that this manufacturing issue is even more important to be addressing right now.
So it sounds like COVAX is a really good and important step, but there's a long journey ahead.
For sure.
The World's Alana Gordon, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Canada typically gets a lot of praise for its healthcare system. But when it comes to distributing coronavirus vaccines, the praise has been short in coming for two very different reasons. Jillian Kohler is a University of Toronto professor focused on global access to medicines and an advisor with the World Health Organization. Jillian, why has Canada's vaccine rollout been so sluggish?
Sluggish is probably a generous term. It's been, quite frankly, a disaster. It's been a disappointing disaster, and it's been tragic. So there's a variety of different reasons. One is we could look at past policy that simply we weren't prepared. We do not have manufacturing capabilities for the coronavirus vaccines currently in Canada. We also have a government that was trying to hedge its bets, but hedged its bets very, very poorly. There's a lot of geopolitical issues related to a possible collaboration with China on a vaccine that fell through. And then there was just sloppy policy whereby we as, I should say the federal government, but we as Canadians were faced with situations where the bilateral agreements with some of the companies weren't read well, so that we were getting shipments instead of on a monthly basis, on a quarterly basis. There's many more reasons, but I can stop there.
So practically, is there simply not enough vaccines on hand now to get Canadians vaccinated? Is it a supply issue right now in terms of what you've got?
We did, absolutely, to answer your question, we did have definite supply issues in the beginning. We had a week or two where there were simply no shipments made. We have been at the mercy of geopolitics. We've been at the mercy of the U.S. My Nation First approach, where even with the new administration wanting to speak to Trudeau as one of the first conversations he had formally with a foreign leader, but still not being willing to share vaccines right now with Canada, even though we are in a need. There are agreements, there are predictions that we will have ample supply. The government made a lot of bilateral deals. But right now, we're still not even close to where we need to be in terms of rollout. We are at the bottom of the barrel in terms of developed countries. This is not where Canada typically is in terms of its healthcare system.
At present, isn't Canada dipping into its supply from COVAX, the international organization that is designed to get vaccines to poorer countries who don't have access? So isn't there sort of a whole kind of, wait, what's going on feeling there right now?
100%. Yeah, I'm glad you raised COVAX. It's something that I've written about recently, criticizing the government for dipping into the first round of vaccines. 1.9 million doses from AstraZeneca are scheduled to arrive, I believe, by June. Don't quote me on June, but in the next couple of months. And to me, what it is, it's an example of just lobby policy, failed policy. And yes, in theory, Canada was negotiating deals which should lead to an overabundance, actually, of supply. And yet the government had to make the decision to go into COVAX and make a deal that we're getting 1.9 million doses, which quite frankly is outrageous when you think of the global supply needs right now. It is not the time to be dipping into COVAX.
So what's the way forward here, Jillian?
Great question. I wish I had an easy answer. What we're seeing right now is supplies are beginning to improve, which is, you know, very, very good. Health Canada recently approved the AstraZeneca vaccine. So hopefully what that means is that our supply situation will change. The other point that I should also mention is that there has been a recent policy recommendation to delay the dose of the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines by 4 months between the first and the second vaccine. So that would allow more people to access to the vaccine for the first time more quickly. So there are positive signs.
Jillian Kohler is a University of Toronto professor focused on global access to medicines. She's also an advisor to the World Health Organization. Thanks a lot, Jillian.
My pleasure.
Now to Baghdad. The Pope arrived in Iraq today to much fanfare. He was greeted at the airport by Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. Pope Francis will be visiting high-ranking officials and religious leaders on a short trip to Iraq. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following the visit and has our story.
Sound of Music filled the main building of Baghdad Airport today. Men and women lined the entrance, arms locked, they danced, welcoming the leader of the Catholic Church to their homeland. The Pope in his white robe and flanked by Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi smiled in acknowledgement. This is the Pope's first visit to Iraq, a country he has said he always wanted to visit. For Iraqis like Balsam Mustafa, a scholar, this marks an emotional moment. Their country is in international spotlight for something other than war.
Watching international coverage of the event, I think it has helped to shed light on a different aspect of Iraq that has been buried under news of violence and conflict.
Mustafa says the sight of dancers in traditional clothes brought tears to her eyes. It was a rare moment, she says, that highlighted Iraq's diversity.
It was exactly this image that should have become the reality. However, this could not have been possible due to the rule of Islamist parties post-2003 who have contributed to drawing and perpetuating a more homogeneous image.
Outside the airport, the Pope was greeted by throngs of well-wishers. They lined the highways, waving the Iraqi and Vatican flags. The Pope has an ambitious itinerary. Today he visited a church and met with political and religious leaders in Baghdad. Tomorrow he heads south to the cities of Najaf and Nasiriyah. One of the high points of his trip is expected to be an interfaith service held at the ancient site of Ur. Ur is believed to be the birthplace of Abraham, a prophet revered by Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Abdulamir Alhamdani researches archaeology and anthropology in Nasiriyah. He's also the country's former minister of culture.
Ur is one of the most important cities and sites in the world.
Hamdani says archaeologists have carried out excavations and research at this site for a long time. The U.S. invasion of 2003 upended some of this work. Fortunately, Hamdani says Ur didn't suffer much damage. For Jafar Jothri at the University of Al-Qasidiyah in Babylon, the Pope's visit to Ur could serve as a reminder to Iraq's leaders that
it is not a site filled with soil or brick. There is lots of stories behind it.
There should be more investments, he says, in these sites, not just because they are part of Iraq's heritage, but also because they could draw international tourists and income. Some Iraqis point out that the government has worked hard to put on a nicely choreographed image of the country, while there are deep grievances among the population. Balsam Mustafa, the Iraqi scholar, says while it's good to see the positive international attention on Iraq, the leaders should not be let off the hook.
This should never replace or erase the complicity of the ruling parties, of post-2003 ruling parties in the current status of Iraq.
The Pope's trip to Iraq is short. He'll leave on Monday. Iraqis hope the energy to present a better Iraq to the world lasts longer. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
This is The World.
Marco Werman here. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, but it's listeners like you from all around the globe who spinned for us and helped us exceed our goal of $100,000. These are some of our supporters who span time zones and borders to help keep the world free for everyone. People like Raffaello Starace, John DiPaolo, Audra Barnes, Anna Lopez, Izaz Manzar, Sean Dorman, Lena Ojgjard Bjorsson, Ellie Owen, Jeffrey Noel, and Marsha Love. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world.
The illegal trade in animals is huge business, but a frog farm in Colombia has come up with a way to fight the poachers, beat them at their own game, legal breeding.
If you sell a frog, then part of the money goes to conservation, but also the person that pays gets educated. I believe it's a win-win situation.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. When the U.S. goes to war, it rarely fights alone. In Afghanistan, the U.S. military has leaned heavily on Afghan interpreters who risk their lives too. But when American troops return home, those Afghans stay behind and can face deadly threats. The U.S. created a visa program to help bring them to safety, but is it working? The World's Monica Campbell reports with an update on one man's story.
Mohammed was upbeat the last time we talked. A U.S. visa seemed on the way.
I am hopeful that I'll get the approval, but, you know, you never know. You never know what happens.
For years, he worked as an interpreter alongside U.S. troops and officials in Afghanistan.
I've been everywhere for them. I've been with the USAID, the Army, the Special Forces, the embassy.
That made him a Taliban target. We're using his middle name only for safety. To visit his family's home, for example, he'd go undercover and hope to avoid Taliban checkpoints.
You can't travel alone in a Ranger, even a convoy, an armored truck. They come under attack.
Mohammed wanted what's called a special immigrant visa. It's for Afghans and Iraqis who've assisted U.S. missions. They're lifelines, but can take years to get. The process can be opaque with unexplained denials. Applications can ping-pong around agencies. Interpreters have sued to speed things up during the Trump and Obama presidencies. The Biden administration pledges to help more. A spokesperson for the U.S. State Department said tens of thousands of visas have been issued to Afghans over the years. Still, about 17,000 Afghans are waiting for visas today. Mohammed had cleared big hurdles, though. He hoped to get to the U.S. soon with his wife and kids.
Everyone. I have four daughters and two sons, six altogether.
But the wait took too long. About a month ago, Mohammed was shot point blank, reportedly by the Taliban.
I was pretty shocked, even though he had been saying his life was under threat by the Taliban for many years.
Stephen Barekia is with the U.S. State Department. He lives in D.C. now, but worked closely with Mohammed in Afghanistan.
In a very almost professorial way, he made me understand Afghanistan culture. You know, I think Afghanistan is far more than what, you know, you see in the paper in terms of the tremendous loss of life and the casualties.
They last spoke over Christmas.
He wrote me and I'm sorry, I'm tearing up a bit. Yeah, no, he, you know, he wished me well. He let me know what was going on. I was telling friends that I thought this was hopefully the year that he would, his visa would come through.
He believes that the State Department has a moral obligation to speed up these visa applications, and he's hoping to get U.S. visas for Mohammed's family. At least 300 Afghan interpreters have been killed since 2014. Their deaths don't make big headlines, but news circulates among U.S. military and officials who've worked closely with them. David Smythe was an Army Special Forces major who now lives in North Carolina. He remembers leading his team along a narrow road in Afghanistan that opened to a big field. His interpreter pulled him aside.
My interpreter said, "We need to stop right now. This looks like an old Soviet minefield."
Where mines the size of hockey pucks from previous wars were buried and could still explode.
And we're like, okay, hey, we back out the way we came in. He was picking up on cues that we would have never picked up on.
Smythe says that not enough people in the U.S. realize the critical role interpreters play on the battlefield. That's why these visas don't get prioritized, he says.
So few people serve in the military. And of that, even fewer actually see combat. So the lack of a national understanding of how important it is because we just don't have a culture of service anymore. I don't think that you can really change the mind of government if the people in the United States don't really see the urgency the way that I see it.
The urgency is clearer than ever for one Afghan who works with the U.S. military. He asked to not use his name for security reasons. He knew Mohammed well and is quite familiar with the threat from the Taliban.
They just know killing. They just know AK-47. They do not know humanity.
Now his family is in danger.
I am also receiving every day, me and my father, brothers, are receiving calls from Taliban that we will be killed.
He hasn't left his house in weeks, he says. He knows the threats are intensifying against people like him, especially as the U.S. considers withdrawing troops and the Taliban regains power. He's also applied for a U.S. visa, the same one Mohammed wanted.
I applied in 2018.
March 2018. That's 3 years so far, waiting for an answer. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
A little more than a year ago, East Africa was hit by a plague that was right out of the Old Testament. Swarms of desert locusts, billions of them, devoured massive amounts of vegetation, including the crops of thousands of subsistence farmers in Kenya. It took months to get the locusts under control, but now the pests are back. And that is deeply worrying because, as the world's Halima Gakandi reports, agriculture is the backbone of Kenya's economy.
Here in Kitui County, desert locusts are dropping from the sky. They're about 4 inches long. Some are pink, others yellow. Catherine Wamboy Mwatha owns a farm here. It's like the biblical plague, says Mwatha. Almost. Kenya has not seen an invasion of desert locusts like this in 70 years. The first wave of locusts arrived in late 2019. This one is part of a second wave, and the swarm here in this area is about 100 million strong. Mwatha says she's scared about what it means for her crops. She grows maize and mung beans. If they reach the farm, they can eat all of the food, says Mwatha. What will me and my children eat then, she asks. County officials are working with the Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO, to try and stop the desert locusts before they do real damage. Cosmas Mwendwa is an agricultural officer with Kitui County. Every day, he's out here on the hunt for locusts.
We get the information from the community where they are, and we come and scout. And if it's a desert locust, then we pick the cornets, we share with the county government team, who shares with the FAO and the national team.
They pick the coordinates, he says, and then they go on the offensive. Workers spray the desert locust swarms with chemical insecticides from the ground using handheld devices in cars. They're also spraying from planes in the air.
We tell the farmers to take like 4 days before taking your cattle or animals to the field.
The animals need to stay away from the areas sprayed by the insecticide. But Wendwa tells me that getting rid of these pests is not easy. It's like a game of cat and mouse. At night, the locusts rest on trees and in bushes. Once the sun comes up, they're energized and on the move.
It's quite challenging because the locusts don't follow the normal route we use. They fly. So you might be told the locusts are in one site, and before you reach in that site, they take off.
By late afternoon, officials have cleared most of the desert locusts from Watha's farmland. Now the ground is littered with them. But the main swarm has already moved on to a different patch of land, less than 10 minutes away. Locals come out to try and scare off the swarm. The noise from yelling and banging pots and pans together works, but only briefly. The locusts move like a game of hopscotch, up and then down again. I call Cosmas Mwendwa, the agricultural officer, to let him know.
Hello. Hi, sasa Cosmas. Talima.
Yes.
We're just leaving on our way back to Kyunyunyo, and there are so many locusts.
I think it's the same swarm, eh?
It's the same swarm. Every time you take a step, more come off the ground.
We'll be following them around because now you know they are flying.
Yes, okay, so you can't do much when they're flying.
Yeah, so we'll just follow them around so we know where they are rooted for the trade tomorrow.
Good luck, good luck.
Mwendwa tells me there isn't much they can do when the locusts are flying, other than trying to keep track of them and waiting until the swarm lands. But so far, he says the damage in this area has been minimal because most of the crops here are mature or have already been harvested. Officials are not taking any chances, though. They're trying to prevent these locusts from breeding a whole new swarm. Hamisi Williams is with the FAO. He says locust swarms are being spotted across the country.
We've seen now desert locust in areas which are traditionally not their breeding areas. Therefore, we largely classify desert locust for us being a weather issue, and that has climate change connotation.
In other words, a combination of weather and climate changes have brought these desert locusts to Kenya. The problem, Williams explains, begins thousands of miles away in the Middle East and Southern Asia. When the weather is wet, he says, locusts can breed quickly. And after they've bred, they move.
And being a migratory pest, they don't look for visas to cross our borders. It becomes a bit difficult to stop them from crossing our borders.
In the worst case scenario, outbreaks of desert locusts can wipe out entire farms and lead to food insecurity. Williams says last year's swarms damaged about 20% of the crops and pastures in affected areas. His focus is on eliminating the current swarms before the main crop season, which is coming up in a few weeks. He says Kenya's food security depends on it.
If the locusts were to be in our fields while our long rain season crops are also at the lush stage, then that would be a disaster that we don't want to happen.
But there are signs now that Kenya is getting the desert locust problem under control. Swarms are already diminishing in Kitui and other parts of the country. Whether or not this will become an annual problem, though, William says it's too early to tell. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Kitui, Kenya.
From locusts to frogs, worldwide illicit trade in wild animals could be worth up to $23 billion annually, according to the United Nations. Thousands of species are affected, but cracking down on these operations, it's not the only way to fight it. In Colombia, a frog farm is trying to defeat poachers by competing against them. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
Working in the dark with a headlamp, Ivan Ramos inspects a small frog that has red and black stripes. Carefully, he stretches its tiny legs to check its bones, then places it in a container that's lined with cotton and foam, and is about the size of a hockey puck. Ramos snaps the container shut before the frog can jump out, and puts it in a cooler where dozens of frogs are already waiting to be exported.
Hoy estamos enviando 68 animales.
Today, we are sending 68 animals to Europe, Ramos explains, as he gets ready to pack the next amphibian. This frog farm is called Tesoros de Colombia, which means treasures of Colombia. In hundreds of glass cases known as terrariums, Tesoros breeds tiny frogs that are about 2 inches long and are native to Colombia's forests. The company sells them to collectors in Europe and the United States. Previously, some of them would have bought the frogs from poachers. Owner Ivan Lozano says he started this farm 10 years ago.
We are helping the authorities fight the animal trafficking. We are giving an alternative for the buyers to get absolutely legal, healthy, captive bred animals.
Colombia is one of the world's richest countries when it comes to amphibians, with more than 800 species. But this natural treasure is also being plundered on a regular basis, which could endanger the survival of some species. Every year, hundreds of frogs are confiscated by police from traffickers at Colombia's airports. A study conducted 2 years ago says that 80,000 members of one species, the Leman's poison frog, have been snatched from the forests to be sold as pets. Lozano says it's almost impossible to stop people from wanting wild animals.
These exotic species are really, really charismatic. And it's really difficult to educate a whole planet of people and tell them, okay, please don't collect them and don't keep them in your house. This is why it's going to be really, really important to develop this kind of sustainable farming.
Lozano's company has permits from Colombia's government to breed 7 kinds of frogs. That's Ufaga histrionica, which has dozens of color combinations that include red and black, blue and black with orange dots. And here's Filobates bicolor. While some people continue to smuggle wild frogs, the demand for these captive bred varieties appears to be growing in the United States.
Every import we have, I see names that I've not seen before.
Joshua Stottlemyre is a collector in Pennsylvania, who helps to handle Tesoro's frogs when they arrive stateside. He quarantines the animals at his home for 2 weeks to make sure they're healthy. Then he ships them to customers across the nation.
And this last import, I quarantined 126, I believe it was, Histrionicus. So we went from a couple dozen to that large of a number.
But wildlife farming hasn't always helped to stop poaching, and there's a risk it can make things worse. In Indonesia, officials allowed the export of 3 million captive bred geckos each year. But that gave some companies a chance to sell thousands of geckos caught in the wild as if they were captive bred. In South Africa, the government allowed owners of game reserves to sell the bones of captive bred lions to Asian countries that use them for traditional medicine. South African zoologist Laura Tenson says this created a new market for lion bones and gave poachers another incentive to go after wild lions.
But that's the main problem, the risk of increasing the demand. And as long as there isn't demand, people will take specimens from the wild. That's just unfortunately how it is, because people see an opportunity to make, to make an income.
Back in Colombia, Ivan Lozano is hoping that frog collectors will be responsible and choose his legally bred specimens over smuggled animals. In the long term, he plans to use profits from his frog farm to fund projects that will restore the animals' habitats.
If you sell a frog and part of the money goes to conservation, but also the person that pays gets educated about conservation, well, I believe it's a win-win situation.
He says the frogs can fund their own conservation programs. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogotá, Colombia.
The week can get busy even when we're not leaving the house. So here's a reminder. We just published a special podcast. It's the latest in our series of conversations with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Clinical psychologist Christy Denkla talks about mental health and grieving. Download that now on your favorite podcast app or find it at theworld.org/listen. Germany has a similar problem to the U.S., a rise in far-right extremism. And given Germany's history, that's very concerning to many Germans. The country is taking unusually strong measures to counter it. It's placed its main opposition political party under surveillance, a dramatic step for a Western democracy, and now the decision is being challenged in German courts. Nicholas Potter researches the German far-right with the Amadeo Antonio Foundation in Berlin. Nicholas, the political party that's being put under surveillance is the Alternative for Germany party, or AfD. What is its platform and how powerful is the party?
Well, the party is often referred to as a right-wing populist party, but I would actually say it's a radical right party. Its platform is very strongly against immigration, especially from refugees. It's very clearly positioning itself as a party that tries to champion some kind of German culture or idea that excludes people who are perceived as not being part of the German heritage and culture. We're also seeing with the AfD that it promotes very ultra-conservative values of the family, which is anti-feminist. And so it represents a lot of the far-right tendencies we're seeing globally in the moment that are manifested in different ways from the US to Brazil to Germany as well.
The AfD is now going to be put under surveillance. What does this actually mean practically?
First of all, I think putting the AfD under surveillance is a very long overdue step. The party has consistently flaunted its undemocratic values, its radical right ideology for several years now. Now that it's being classed as a case of suspected right-wing extremism, this means that intelligence services can, for example, monitor the party's communication via wiretaps. It means they can use paid informants, and it also means that they can collect and save data on the party membership structure. And I also think it's important to stress that this step shows that just because a party is democratically elected, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's democratic itself.
I'm curious about the legal authority here. I mean, how can German intelligence basically set up a surveillance operation for a German political party that has many seats in the German parliament and, like it or not, plays a major role overall in German politics?
The name of the German Domestic Intelligence Service in German, it translates as the Office for the Protection of the Constitution. So in post-war Germany, you have a concept of a defendable democracy, a democracy that's in a position to defend itself against extremist elements. And this is based on the turbulent history of Germany and the problems in the past. Obviously, this is not without legal hiccups and challenges on the way. before it basically hit the media this week that the AFD was going to be a suspected case of far-right extremism, the AFD had already launched court proceedings against the intelligence services. And this was in Cologne. What the courts in Cologne said was that while they evaluate this, the intelligence services are not allowed to publicly say what the decision is going to be, whether the AFD is going to be a suspected case or not and put under observation.
So at this point, as of now, the AFD has not been put under surveillance yet while they sort out these legal issues?
So the intelligence services have already begun surveying the AFD because internally they are now a suspected case of far-right extremism. What happened today was that the courts in Cologne said that the intelligence services are not allowed to treat the AFD as a suspected case of right-wing extremism until a decision by the court in Cologne has been made. So that's the big change today.
It's interesting because this year, 2021, is a big year in German politics. There's elections at almost every level, including at the federal level, to see who succeeds Angela Merkel, who's been in power for 16 years. Is this being seen as a kind of way to affect those elections by cracking down on the AFD?
Definitely. I think that this sends a very clear signal that the AFD is not operating within the realm of democratic normality. It is a warning shot to say, if you want to be a member of this party, you are operating within the political far right. In terms of how it will affect the AFD's chances, this is hard to say. On the one hand, obviously now the AFD has become politically more toxic. So this means if you're a civil servant, a public official, even in the ranks of the police, there's a lot of support for the AFD. This now means it's highly problematic. On the other hand, the AFD love being in the victim role. And once again, they're able to stylize themselves as the political outsiders against a parliamentary elite or establishment.
Nicholas Potter is with the Amadeo Antonio Foundation in Berlin, where he researches the German far right. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you very much.
Finally today, in the new novel Clara and the Sun, a sickly girl bonds with a robot named Clara.
I think she's more like a doll or a soft toy in children's, you know, like young children's literature.
That's Kazuo Ishiguro, the British Nobel Prize-winning author, perhaps best known for his book Remains of the Day. He's this week's guest on The Economist Asks, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Ishiguro spoke with host Anne McElvoy about Clara and the Sun, a book that tackles relationships between humans and artificial intelligence.
I was fascinated by this viewpoint of a creature that was very much outside of the human world, but would actually observe it from a slightly odd perspective.
She's called the artificial friend. Technologically, how would you describe her? She's more than a robot, isn't she? We often write about the difference between machine learning and where that fits with broader AI at The Economist. But it strikes me that the thing that makes her really interesting is going to drive a lot of the plot is her relationship with empathy.
I mean, this is one of the questions that would always be there in the reader's mind. Does she have empathy? Does she actually understand human emotions? Or is she just observing human emotions and therefore, to some extent, simulating them within herself? It's hard to know. I mean, it becomes a very interesting question for us, but it's a question for Clara too. And so she focuses on questions like that. What are human emotions? You know, how do they work? And in particular, she's fascinated by human loneliness because that's the kind of reward function that's built into her, is to stop teenagers from becoming lonely. So she sees the human world to some extent through the lens of loneliness. And then as her vision of the world becomes more complicated, she still relates things back to loneliness. You know, when people cluster together in families or they talk about loving each other, is that some way of avoiding loneliness? Can they actually fundamentally avoid loneliness? Is there something about human beings that makes them lonely by virtue of the fact that they are so, each person is so complex and complicated that it's very hard to build bridges with each other? This is what Clara observes. It's hard to know whether she is having real emotions or not. And I suppose the question comes back, I mean, what are our emotions as human beings? What do they amount to?
Nobel Prize-winning author Kazuo Ishiguro discussing his new novel, Clara and the Sun, with Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks. To hear more of their conversation, search for Economist Radio wherever you get your podcasts. That does it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back again Monday.